The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Almighty God, we praise you particularly now for the revelation of your own righteousness in the gospel of your Son. We thank you, our God, again, that it is the power, your power for salvation to everyone who believes. Our God, we thank you that by your grace, your gospel grace, we find ourselves among those who live from faith to faith. And we ask that above all, and all that we're reflecting on as we concentrate on this wonderful revelation of your righteousness, that we might grow in our own understanding, that we might experience for ourselves something of its full dimensions. We ask that in all our reflections here, you will keep us from going beyond, either by addition or subtraction, from what the apostle, by your Spirit, has penned for the good of your church until our Lord Jesus Christ, the righteous one, returns. We pray in his name. Amen. Okay, what you've all been waiting for is here. Are you going to be able to concentrate for the next... by the way, on extraneous, I mean, for the Ohio State people here, sort of really unruly fans, I hear, it's violence. I was going to try to make up the 20 minutes that we lost on the short schedule here, but I won't do it today. We'll do that another time. I mean, we'll be out of here right at the dot of one. You can... I have enough only for the people who are registered for the course to, these are the assignments coming around. Hold it, I need one, thanks. There's not a whole lot to be said. What I try to do, I took the requests as they came in order. If I couldn't honor your very first choice, I tried to assign you to another person on the same passage. Some of you gave some flexibility, and so I use that opportunity to move around. Notice as you get it that there are 24 slots out of the 25 that have been filled by the people registered. We have no one for Kazeman on November 21st. If someone else would like to take that rather than an assignment I've made, that would be quite fine with me. For that matter, you may horse trade with other assignments. Just let me know what's happening. But I think in most instances I was able to at least give you one choice. Everybody that's registered, get that. Okay, now, in the flow of our notes, we had focused on what I think I had called our fourth exegetical note. Going on at some length, we'd elaborated, developed a discussion of focusing on the bracketing concept, the signature that Paul puts on the document as a whole, capturing his large concern, his appointment as apostle for the spread of the obedience of faith among the nations. We picked up on that expression as it came out of the opening segment, as the apostle there highlights a certain, brings into view certain concepts that will already that prepare us or point already to what he is going to, what is involved in verse 17, what's usually recognized as the theme statement of the document. And we want to come now, and this would be, let's call this the fifth point, or the fifth note. Where we will look in verse 17 at the concept of the righteousness of God, the dikaiosune theou. And maybe we should just read again. We already indicated as one of our earlier notes that this is customarily seen. Latter part, 16 and 17, the latter part of verse 16, 17, 17, people look at it differently as announcing the theme of the verse. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, Jew first and Greek. For in it, the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it's written, the just shall live by faith. We're going to proceed now over the next several weeks. Well, first of all, we're going to spend time on the righteousness of God as probably the central conception here. We'll also then eventually focus on approaching, giving us a little bit opportunity to delve into Paul's use of the Old Testament on the use of Habakkuk here at the end of the verse, and also this expression from faith to faith is where we'll be going. Let me just say that in view of a number of considerations, I want to make sure that I get through certain material. You can see that we're not moving through the book of Romans in rapid overview here. I have skipped over a couple of notes of a briefer character. Let me just even more briefly indicate what we've skipped over. The reference to the gospel in verse 12. And no more here than an indication of what I would have reflected on. What I think is interesting in verse 12 is that Paul says that, no, it's not in verse 12.
9.
No. What's my problem here? Where Paul says, 15. Trying to read my mind. Where he says that he has purposed to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. And I think what's noteworthy is the way in which Paul signalizes that it is not, if you will, it's not playing on the English derivative from the Greek word, the Greek verb euangelizomai. It's not to the unevangelized that he is coming to evangelize, but he wants to evangelize the evangelized. He wants to preach the gospel to the church already established. And I think that highlights the point that the church in its life concerns never gets beyond the gospel message as Paul understands it. Then also, another note reflecting on this opening statement here, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And I think the point that needs to be made here, almost certainly not to set up false oppositions, is that this is not so much an expression of Paul's psychology, as if he's saying, I'm one of those Christians who's very bold in my witnessing. I don't feel uncomfortable in the presence of unbelievers because I'm a Christian. That dimension might be there. But it's not that. It's not psychological shame, but I think it has, especially as we do justice to this statement as having a more formal, thematic character, it has a more objective sense in this, in comes down to the force of I confess the gospel. I am not ashamed in the sense of I am committed to the gospel, whatever my state of mind might be at any particular time. I think you could connect it, for instance, with the statements in the gospel material where Jesus says, those who are ashamed before me, men, I will be ashamed of before my Father in heaven. Those who confess me before men, I will confess before my Father in heaven. So to be ashamed is to not confess, and to confess is to not be ashamed. So I think there's that dimension likely there. Yes?
How would that differ from saying that you're going to be uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, there may be people. I mean, there's a spectrum of psychological disposition, if you will, in believers. Some are very bold and very aggressive. I think the point is that Paul is saying here, however I feel on a particular day, I'm not ashamed. That is, I'm confessing the gospel. I'm saying, I don't want to eliminate. I don't want to set up a false opposition here. But the point is not a psychological point. As much as it is a matter of formal confession, being ready to, or an objective point of confession, no matter how one might feel. Okay.
I'm saying that's reflected in that word itself.
Yeah, I think particularly when you see the, make the connection here in the context, and especially, you know, what does it mean for Jesus to say that at the day of judgment he will not be ashamed or be ashamed? So I think it's bound up with the idea of acknowledging or confessing.
I'm trying to see the connection between what Jesus said here. Was Paul thinking those lines, or was he talking from the context where he was in the midst of
I think it's most helpful if you see not ashamed as basically a equivalent to confess. And he is saying, I confess the gospel, and particularly I confess it in these terms. And that then serves as an introductory to what is properly seen, as I'm going to argue here, as the theme of the entire document. It's not to deny that other dimension may be present, but I don't think that's precisely the point. But maybe I still haven't gotten your question. It's just that I think there's a kind of formal solemnity in the Jesus statements, and that's the connection I was wanting to draw here.
Yeah, I didn't see that connection between what Jesus said and what Paul is writing here. I'm failing to see the connection, a direct connection, but is that what he had in mind, or maybe not?
Well. I don't think he's so much thinking here of the final judgment, but it's more the idea of making an objective confession.
Perhaps.
Go ahead.
From the context that I'm coming from, that I identify with that, with the personalized drive that Paul is having.
Right.
I don't want to see everything.
Yeah, well,
I
think the demands in a third world situation, or the circumstances in a third world situation, would be distinct to a particular situation. But I don't really think, in the respect that you're raising the point, I don't think it's that different for living in the West, which you know, where the powers that be, you know, to say you're a Christian in a context, you know, in our own culture, you know. that immediately you're looked down on. And I'm not saying that that is not involved here. I'm not sure that that's, and other commentators have raised this point, that that is the prominent point, as if Paul is saying, I'm a very bold witness for Jesus Christ. Yes.
The form of designated expression presumes a kind of opposition to circumstance, whereas in Mark 10, don't be ashamed, point is there's lots of brethren who want to make you ashamed.
Yeah.
I won't be ashamed that no matter what sin you have done, if you claim me, that won't be weighed against. But there's a polemical or oppositional quality to what he's doing.
Yes, the negative form, I think, comes from undoubted opposition. I think that's also what you want to... you're concerned to underline too. Okay, I might as well have run through the note the way I had it in my notes. Okay. That's good, probably. All right. So we can call this, let's still call this five, the righteousness of God. Kazeman says, in commenting on the verse here, that we arrive at the fork in the road for all subsequent exposition of Romans. And I think that impression is widely shared. That's on page 24. Well, you find it under his comments on verse 17. So that not only is there a widespread perception that the verse contains the controlling concept, the theme of the epistle, but the decisions that are made here are decisive for the interpretation that follows. Now, so far, we've laid some background, we might say, in looking at the opening verses. Touching on some of the key concepts that we find here in verse 16 and 17, the reference to the gospel, the power of God. Remember that came in verse 4 in the reference to the resurrection. And then the nature of faith. We are giving, I guess, considerable time to that as we explored the obedience of faith. Concept. By the way, it just popped into my head. Douglas, if you would see me on the side of the matter. Now, here then we come on what has been a matter of perennial debate, not only for Romans, but for Paul's theology as a whole. And we're taking it up here in the framework of this course because it has far-reaching dogmatic implications, this notion of the righteousness of God, or more broadly connected with the verb here, the revelation of the righteousness of God, the revelation of the righteousness of God. Now, that expression appears elsewhere in Paul. Let me just take the time to jot them down here. The large majority are in the book of Romans in chapter 3. We'll be looking at some, if not all, of these later on in different contexts of our discussion. 22, 25, and 26. In chapter 10, 3. These are not just references to righteousness now, which are going to want to draw into our discussion, as you'll see, but... the phrase, the noun combination with the genitive theou, righteousness of God. It also occurs in 2 Corinthians 5:21. You might recognize right off. That's a prominent Pauline direct assertion that Christ became sin in order that we in Him might be the righteousness of God, and then. There's the reference in Philippians 3:9. Now, the way we'll proceed here, and the discussion is somewhat lengthy. Well, first of all, identify the basic issue, or really a set of issues, then having done that, we will set out, as it appears to me, what are some guidelines for interpretation. That will be section B. And then having, through that discussion, brought things to a certain, I hope, clear focus, we'll go on and then do our own exegesis in terms of several steps. Now, by way of getting at a basic issue here, or a central exegetical question, we can orient ourselves to the history of interpretation very briefly. And that history, the interpretive history, the issues involved, can be focused on by picking up on a particular debate, which until recently, and probably still is the case, is unresolved so far as a census is concerned, although I think there is something of a more recently a consensus emerging more so than in the past. That is, we want to focus here, as we look at the history of interpretation, on the debate as to the precise force of the genitive. That's the way that can be our window on the history of interpretation. The force of the genitive theou. So, by the way, you might already recognize that. Formally, we're getting involved, the exegetical state of affairs is roughly parallel, at least, to what we're looking at in hupakoue pisteos, the force of the genitive. Much of the discussion turned around that. Now, it won't be exactly parallel here, as we'll see. Okay, really leapfrogging through the history of interpretation, not so much to get at it in any depth, but to give a basic profile. First of all, looking at the period prior to the Reformation, thinking of the attention given to Romans, and especially to this verse and this expression in the Greek and Latin fathers and through the medieval period. We can say, generalizing, that for this period, theou is a subjective genitive. The genitive is subjective. More specifically, it is a subjective genitive in the sense of referring the righteousness of God is an essential attribute of God, an abiding mark of his character. We can say that throughout this period, exegesis is very much under the sway of Aristotelian ethics and the notion of righteousness that is there, or even more generally, the Greek philosophical conception of virtue, so that through this period, the righteousness of God is, as much as anything, his equity. Moving into Latin, his equitas. That, in other words, the righteousness of God is seen as God's fairness or his judicial impartiality. More particularly, it is seen then as the justice of God in the sense of his distributive or retributive, most pointedly, the divine attribute of retributive justice. Justice, then, which as retributive, specifically in the case of man as sinner, can only be God's punitive justice, his vindictive justice. Now, I think you can see without too much difficulty that on this line of reflection, Romans 1:17 becomes an insoluble conundrum. Not simply insoluble, becomes a quite disconcerting declaration. and a conundrum, as we have said, because how, on this, to take it on this understanding, how can God's distributive justice be called gospel, which is what Paul does here. He says the righteousness of God is gospel. But how, if that justice is distributive or punitive, how can that be gospel? Where is the good news in that? Where is the good news in the revelation of the punitive justice of God? And that, of course, you may recall, is the problem of the young Luther with this text. He hated it. As he even said, he hated God. Now, of course, it's not as if this period just left this whole dilemma unaddressed. There are efforts to overcome. In other words, to find some gospel on this distributive understanding. Those efforts unfolded, for the sake of presentation here, along at least two lines that we can mention. What happens is various efforts are made to combine the notion of God's justice, as we've indicated it was understood, to combine that notion with his grace, so that the righteousness of God is that by which he enables the sinner, or the righteousness of God involves his activity by which he enables the sinner, through the use of the sacraments, to a love, to an active love that merits forgiveness. That, for instance, would be an approximate way of describing, a general way of describing the view of Abelard. Coming closer to the mark, but not really breaking with this tradition, is the view of Augustine, who argues that the righteousness of God becomes the grace of God. Or it is, the righteousness of God in view here is the righteousness of God because it is the grace of God by which he justifies sinners. The grace of God here is called righteousness, in effect, because it is the grace by which he justifies sinners. Now, the problem, what's very problematic then about the Augustinian view, as some of you may be aware, for all that he is a precursor of much of the Reformation, his understanding of justification is still that it is by the infusion of righteousness in the believer. So, secondly, with that sketch, we can move on and note the development, quite a radical reassessment that comes with the Reformers. And look at, especially in terms of the force of the genitive, well, let me back up and before we specify the force of the genitive. The righteousness of God by the Reformers is not a divine attribute, but a divine gift. You can see that that was being grasped at, however imperfectly, in the Augustinian tradition. But now the force, very pointedly, it's not an attribute, but a gift. And more importantly, for the Reformation, as a gift, it is not a matter of imperfect infused righteousness, but of the perfect righteousness of Christ imputed, sola fide. As the righteousness of God as gift is not an imperfect infusion, as the medieval tradition never got away from, but it is a imputed righteousness, the perfect righteousness of Christ. This is the discovery that Luther made in connection just with his reflection on our verse. And you may recall often quoted statement, but always worth quoting again, by which he says, as he came to see it here, "I felt that I was completely reborn and entered through open doors into paradise itself." So on this view, the genitive is not a subjective genitive, but it is a relational genitive. A relational genitive. This is the sense that Calvin prefers. The righteousness which holds before God. The righteousness of God in the sense of the righteousness which is approved at his tribunal. Or alternatively, it can be seen as a genitive of source. Genitive of source or origin. The righteousness then which proceeds from God, or as Calvin seeks to capture it on this understanding, the righteousness which is given to us by God. And Calvin goes on to say, having set out these two options, he says he can accept both. He prefers the first, the relational, but he can accept the source understanding. He's not going to quibble over it as long as we keep clear that the righteousness of God in view is imputed righteousness. Imputed righteousness. Ritterboss, Hermann Ritterboss, coming along sometime later, but in this tradition, in his Romans commentary, that's a Dutch, in Dutch, not translated into English, especially interacting with Calvin, says he thinks that it's difficult to insist on one or the other, the relational or the source, and in an anticipation of direction that interpretation as a whole is going to go on bringing in other issues into the picture, he thinks Paul intends both. Both senses are there in essence. Now, moving then to look at the period since the Reformation, or if I could nuance since the Reformation a little bit more specifically, I was going to say judgmentally, but I don't think it's prejudicial. I'm thinking here primarily of the understanding in the modern and more specifically historical critical tradition. The understanding of the righteousness of God in the historical critical period. Developments then basically since the Enlightenment, because the period of the 17th century is essentially a consolidation of the Reformation and maintains the post-Reformed and Lutheran orthodoxy is quite at one with the Reformation, with the Reformers. Maybe just break down our discussion here into a couple of sub-points. What we witness in the period beyond the Reformation is the decline of Protestant orthodoxy in its two mainstreams. Decline in the sense of its massive influence in Northern Europe, and then in time in the New World. And with the decline of orthodoxy goes the abandonment of its doctrine of justification. That is, justification is based on the gift of God, the gratuitously imputed righteousness of Christ. Now you can understand then without too much difficulty that that will involve a reassessment of the righteousness of God. The righteousness of God is going to have now to be redefined. And here let's even be more specific, coming moving things to late 19th century developments, for the theological liberalism that becomes dominant, what we witness in terms of the force of the genitive is a return to the subjective force or subjective understanding, a return to a subjective understanding, but with a not really a return to the pre-Reformation understanding, because there's a different twist now. It's a subjective understanding, not in the sense of a divine attribute, a fixed, immutable characteristic of God's person, but an activity of God. It's the righteousness of God, more specifically in terms of a divine activity. So you could distinguish between attribute, an attribute understanding of the subjective genitive, and now an activity. And just to trace how this all works out, as I was going to say, the active sense comes in, I think, fairly well bound up with the dynamism that characterizes post-Enlightenment philosophy and finds its way into theology, putting everything in activistic categories. But more specifically for this liberalism, the righteousness of God, in effect, is the love of God. The love of God. For God to be righteous means his loving activity. So on this understanding, the righteousness of God is that love by which he overcomes really what is nothing more on in this view measured by others, his fatherly displeasure. The love is that by which God overcomes, he eclipses, gets over his fatherly peak with his unruly children, if I don't think that's an unfair way of characterizing things. And that is what wrath is on the liberal understanding. The wrath of God is his loving and fatherly displeasure. So the righteousness of God is that by which God overcomes his fatherly displeasure and continues to embrace his errant and imperfect children. And that's what sin is on the liberal construction, a matter of making mistakes and being imperfect. So, on this view, at least measured by biblical standards, there is no longer any element of judgment in the justice that is involved in the righteousness of God. We have a concept of justice in which love swallows up every other consideration and eliminates any notion of judgment, especially retributive judgment. So just to highlight again here, I guess maybe it's already clear, we move from an attribute understanding to a gift understanding to an activity understanding of the righteousness of God. Now, to more directly set the stage for our own reflections, let's try to capture the situation as it develops through this century. We can say increasingly since World War I, with the so-called demise of liberal theology, which is not really its demise, but we won't get in to that here. But I'm thinking of the emergence of Karl Barth in his presumed bombshell in the playground of the theologians, which was, remember, his commentary on Romans, especially the second edition. Increasing dissatisfaction with the liberal understanding. And within that dissatisfaction, what we can single out is an increasing recognition of the undeniable forensic element, the forensic dimension of the Dikaiosune. In a sense, you see, the liberal conception had virtually eliminated the forensic, the judicial, in the strict sense, made it a metaphor for an expression of love. And increasingly, in the period beyond the First World War, there's recognition exegetically, you just can't do that. There is a forensic dimension, you have to deal with it somehow. At the same time, a concern to retain the soteriological force of the notion. So you can say that at least formally, there's a certain effort here to a return to the insight of the Reformation. More particularly, we can focus in on a discussion that got going in the late 60s and has continued. Most commentaries written since 1960 will make reference to this debate. But a debate that got going between Bultmann and Casaubon, especially as Casaubon is, in the history of recent modern theology, you can sort of see him as Bultmann's unruly disciple. He's a disciple of Bultmann, and yet he's always chafing against his teacher and goes on his own way as a so-called post-Bultmannian. Now, that debate between the two can be highlighted, stylized in this way. Bultmann, on the one hand, by the way, this is in an interchange beginning with I guess I'm not really sure now if it begins with an essay by Bultmann or Casaubon, one or the other, but focusing on the righteousness of God, the Dikaiosune Theou. It's approached in very strictly linguistic terms, even though they both get into the theological ramifications. I think Bultmann's comes first. At any rate, he represents his position as following the Reformers, and insisting then that the Dikaiosune Theou is a gift, and that the genitive Theou, the genitive is a genitive of source. This is Bultmann. And more specifically, in terms of, for those of you who have read some Bultmann or know Bultmann, when he talks about the, I think we get a bell here in a minute or so. When Bultmann talks about the righteousness of God as a gift, he is not thinking, at least as the Reformers thought, of the gift of imputed righteousness, but as he would wish to put it in demythologized form, the gift is the authentic existence whose possibility is opened up in the gospel. That is what the gospel does. It opens up the possibility of authentic existence. And that authentic existence is, of course, defined in existentialist theological categories, much influenced by Heidegger. And that's what the righteousness of God is. Casaubon, however, is insistent that the genitive is a subjective genitive. A subjective genitive, so that more specifically, if we can bring in categories into our discussion that we're going to utilize for ourselves, Whereas for Bultmann, the righteousness of God is a gift. For Kazeman, the righteousness of God is power. It's a power reality. More specifically, as Kazeman sees it, the righteousness of God, the dikaiothuneitheu, is the saving faithfulness of God as creator. The saving fidelity of God to his creation. It is that activity of God by which he prevails as Lord over the creation. Let me just round this point off, take a break. And in this connection, Kazeman faults Bultmann, in effect, for absolutizing the gift aspect. And if you know any of the discussion around the theology of Bultmann, that's tied up with the increasing criticism of Bultmann, that he is entirely too, that he has narrowed the gospel anthropologically, an anthropological narrowing that focuses only on the individual believer. So Kazeman says, Bultmann has absolutized the gift aspect, which Kazeman, for his part, does not want to exclude, but he sees the gift aspect as secondary to the power aspect, the gift aspect as derivative of the power aspect.